I have met sociopaths in these use apps who fantasize about using these technologies to go into space, like Star Wars with guns blazing, parenthesis, see some in these GovIT projects have misinterpreted certain ET actions. For example, when we tried to detonate a nuclear weapon on the moon back in the late 1970s/early 1980s in order to demonstrate to the USSR how powerful America was, an extraterrestrial vehicle came in and intercepted and destroyed it. Now, one could take that to be evidence that these ETs were hostile towards us, when in reality they were trying to protect their facilities on the moon, parenthesis, see secret file, extraterrestrial moon bases, and also the sanctity of space as a peaceful place free from weapons of mass destruction. A number of such events have happened, where humans have misinterpreted ET actions as evidence of hostility, when in reality, it was evidence of enlightenment. These extraterrestrial civilizations are simply trying to contain an immature and out-of-control militarized civilization on Earth from escaping the biosphere and going out into space. Depending on your perspective, you can view it as one way or another. I am quite certain that the ET intent is peaceful. But if you wanted to spin such an event to someone else inclined to support space weapons, you could cite that event and say, see, there is a real ET threat we are facing. We need to build up weapons in space and hit them hard. I am not speaking theoretically as I give you these examples. These are things that have actually happened and have led to justifications for targeting extraterrestrial vehicles and weaponizing space. We have witnesses to ET events where 16 to 18 intercontinental ballistic missiles were taken offline completely and instantly. When I asked them, what do you think the ETs were saying? Their responses were, we think they were trying to tell us, please don't blow up this beautiful planet. What a lot of people don't know is that similar events were happening in Russia at exactly the same time. ET actions were trying to say to all these aggressive nuclear parties on Earth, make peace, and don't go down this path of mutual self-destruction. And if you try, we're going to stop you. They weren't out to give the Soviets an advantage over us, they were doing the same things in the Soviet Union at the same time. And yet President Reagan's military advisors used these events to push for the Star Wars Defense Shield. ET civilizations certainly are not going to let us send these weapons into space. When covert shadow government operations have tried to go out in space with ARVs and other super advanced spacecraft, they have been shut down. A Defense Intelligence Agency witness told me that we had a number of sophisticated satellite systems that were pointed out into space, not at Russia. They were being used to track and target extraterrestrial vehicles. He said the ETs were routinely shutting these systems down, out of self-defense. The idea that extraterrestrial civilizations will come to Earth in order to impose some new order is a fantasy. These are lessons that we have to learn as a people who are stumbling out of childhood's end and into maturity and adulthood. Extraterrestrial civilizations have been observing our development for quite a while, certainly hundreds if not thousands of years, perhaps far longer. They will not allow one perverse generation to destroy a biosphere that has been in development for billions of years, or a world that is intended to be here for hundreds of thousands to millions of years to evolve as a place for the development of intelligent life and enlightenment. As such, Earth is under a type of cosmic quarantine. It is known that we are not yet socially and spiritually evolved enough to go into space with such advanced technologies. And so our wings are clipped, for now. The key to our being welcome in the cosmos is peace. Testimonial. Richard Doty was a special agent for counterintelligence for the Air Force Office of Special Investigations, AFOSI. For over 8 years, he was specifically tasked with the UFO/extraterrestrial issue at Kirtland Air Force Base in New Mexico, and also at Nellis Air Force Base, the so-called Area 51, and at other locations. The concern was, what were they after? Was it a reconnaissance flight before an invasion? Were they going to land and take over some particular facility for their own purpose? Were they short of minerals? because a lot of what we were told toward the end of the film, parenthesis, briefing film into Yankee Black program, was that a lot of these crafts were later seen over uranium mines and other mining areas. And so the concern was, what are they after? Are they after uranium to turn into plutonium? And so our job was to investigate and determine if there was a threat and report it up the chain of command. Parenthesis, SG, the fact that we had developed, tested, and had detonated two atomic bombs certainly seemed to have drawn the ET's attention. Roswell had the only atomic bomb squadron in the world at the time, as well as uranium mines. Colonel Didrikson, one of the Disclosure Project witnesses, said that every one of our facilities had been subjected to ET reconnaissance. Was that discussed? Parenthesis, Rode. They inferred it, they were concerned. The way the colonel put it, we had just dropped two atomic bombs on a country and we had a test of that nuke a few weeks earlier in New Mexico, and this was probably observed by these aliens somewhere, whether they were doing reconnaissance back then or how they had figured it out. So they came here to observe and to figure things out. And maybe they didn't have a weapon like that, and maybe they did. And maybe they were concerned about this Earth for some particular reason, and or maybe they were after those weapons. And that was a concern, because security in nuclear weapons was a number one priority of the United States Air Force, because the Air Force had a lot of nuclear weapons. One of the primary missions for OSI was to protect counterintelligence operations against the threat of nuclear weapons. And Kirtland Air Force Base had a lot of nuclear weapons, while New Mexico, at the time, had the 509th Bomb Wing at Roswell, the only nuclear-capable strike force in the United States at that time. 11 I was at Pease Air Force Base in 1984. It was a strategic air command base in northern New York, but it is no longer there. They had a very peculiar incident when a UFO was flying around their nuclear weapons storage area, landed, and they found out that a weapon was taken apart. There wasn't anyone in the bunker to do that. They thought maybe it was a Russian operation. I went up there, and during this operation we found prints, fingerprints. But they weren't like our fingerprints. When I was originally briefed about the ET/UFO issue, I saw photos of creatures who had two hands on one arm, one appendage. It would appear something like that had gotten in there. So now we had fingerprints, and that was the first time that we, as a government, had actually gotten extraterrestrial fingerprints. There were many, many cases of UFOs spotted around nuclear weapon facility lots, control facilities, Ellsworth Air Force Base, Malmstrom Air Force Base, and then SAC bases that had nuclear weapons. Dot. Testimonial. Captain Robert Sallers, U.S. Air Force. In March of 1967, I was stationed at Malmstrom Air Force Base, Montana, as a missile launch officer. Minuteman missiles. On an early morning in March, I got a call from my primary security guard upstairs. We had about six, as I recall, flight security airmen upstairs. I was downstairs, 60 feet underground in a capsule, monitoring and controlling 10 nuclear-tipped Minuteman missiles. The guard reported seeing strange lights flying in the sky. I told them to call me when something more significant happened. I received a subsequent call, and this time there was a more intense tone in the guard's voice. He was clearly very frightened. He said there was a bright, glowing red object hovering outside the front gate. It was oval-shaped. He had all the other guards out there with their weapons drawn. I woke up my commander, Colonel Fred Mywald, and told him about the phone calls. As we were speaking, my weapons started going down one after the other, moving into a no-go condition. They were unlaunchable. We lost somewhere between 6 and 8 weapons that morning within minutes of having received that second phone call of a UFO hovering outside the front gate. That same morning, we were informed that a very similar incident had happened at Echo Flight. They lost all 10 of their weapons under similar circumstances where UFOs were sighted over the launch facilities. They had maintenance crews and security crews out there that had spent the night, and they were reporting UFOs over those sites. We have witnesses who will back up this story. We also have documentation that I received through FOIA requests from the Air Force outlining the Echo Flight incident, and including in that documentation reference to UFOs. We have telexes covering this incident, and in one telex it says the fact that no apparent reason for the loss of 10 missiles can be readily identified is cause for grave concern to this headquarters. This was from SAC headquarters. So we've received. We've got those telexes. I've also got the complete report on a similar incident reported at Minute Air Force Base in North Dakota, which happened in August of 1966. Very similar, again, a UFO sighted over missile silos, and also a UFO incident that was investigated by the Air Force immediately within a week of our encounter. Testimonial. Major George A. Filer III was an Air Force intelligence officer. He was a navigator in various aircraft and tanker transport aircraft and frequently briefed generals and congressmen on our capabilities and the threat to U.S. forces. I worked as the Deputy Director of Intelligence for the 21st Air Force, which controlled half the military aircraft that flew the presidents and the various VIPs from the Mississippi River around to India. We had some 300 aircraft, and we were flying all kinds of missions. Almost anything that had to do with military airlift. On the morning of January 18, 1978, I drove through the main gate at McGuire Air Force Base and noticed that there were red lights out on the runway, indicating something unusual was happening. When I arrived at the 21st Air Force Command Post, I was met by the head of the post who told me it had been a very exciting evening. We had UFOs flying over McGuire all night and one had apparently landed or possibly crashed at Fort Dix. A military policeman had come upon the alien and had shot him. I was a bit confused and asked if the foreigner had been killed. Not a foreigner, an alien from outer space. Apparently a UFO had been shot down at Fort Dix. The extraterrestrial .A gray being about the size of a child, had run away after being wounded, heading for the steel fence separating Fort Dix from McGuire. The ET either climbed the fence or went under it and got to McGuire, where it was shot and died at the end of the runway. IC-141 from Wright-Patterson was en route to pick up the remains. Security police were guarding the dead body. The head of the post said he wanted me to brief General Tom Sadler that we had captured an alien. I called the 38th Military Airlift Wing Command Post to confirm the story. They said, yes, they had heard the same information. They said that this actually did happen. That an alien life form was found on the base. Later that morning, I was told that they cancelled the briefing. I carried the code word down to General Sadler's office, and I noticed some commotion going on in there, and that some of the security police were there, looking rather disheveled. Since General Sadler was a stickler for everyone looking perfect, it was surprising to see these people that obviously needed shaves and were in fatigues, so then I knew that this might tie into the story that I had heard. After the briefing I went to the photo lab. Almost every day I went there. These briefings have four screens and you have to keep them all filled up with pretty pictures. The lab indicated that they had taken pictures of something extraordinary, and I said, well, let me see them. The sergeant was handing them to me, when his master sergeant said, he can't see those, so all I knew is that they had some pictures that I wasn't allowed to see. As the general's briefer, I had never been stopped from seeing any pictures before. It was a very serious operation. There are nuclear assets on the base. They used to carry nuclear weapons back and forth to Europe. And I talked to one of the security policemen who claimed to have been out there. He indicated that he essentially saw a small body that could have been like a child, but it seemed to have a larger than normal head. I heard that they had been listening on their radios while this chase was going on, that the alien had been shot at Fort Dix. For whatever reason, it chose to run towards McGuire Air Force Base. And that both the state police and the military police were chasing this ET which came from what looked like a UFO. As I understand it, it was a disc-shaped craft. UFOs had been in the area for quite some time that evening. They had them on radar and the tower operator had seen them. Some of the other aircraft in the area had apparently seen them as well. 6 to 8 people had been guarding the body. Then there was the commander of the security police and a few of us in the command post who knew of this event. I assume that General Sadler was briefed about it. Many of the key personnel on the base at that time who had a connection with this event were quickly transferred from the wing commander on down, indicating that if you knew something, they tended to split you up so you couldn't talk about it. This was done within a matter of weeks. The security policeman told me that he was transferred within a few days. As a matter of fact, he was taken to Wright-Patterson within a day or two, debriefed by a number of people, and essentially told not to talk about it anymore. Testimonial. Robert Jacobs is a former lieutenant in the US Air Force and a respected professor at a major US university. In the 1960s, I was the officer in charge of optical instrumentation in the 1369th Photo Squadron at Vandenberg Air Force Base in California. It was my duty to supervise the instrumentation photography of every missile that was launched and film the ballistic missile tests. In 1964, we were testing ballistic missiles that were to deliver nuclear payloads. We weren't launching real nuclear weapons, we were launching dummy nukes. They were the exact size, shape, dimension and weight of a nuclear warhead. In those days we called them ICBM*S. Inter-county ballistic missiles. Because most of them blew up on launch. Our job was to provide the engineers with good sequential photography so that they could see what went wrong with the burners that took off in flight. For my achievement in setting up the photographic station to track these tests, I was awarded the Air Force Guided Missile Insignia. I was the first photographer in the Air Force to get the missile badge and it was a highly coveted thing at the time. The incident happened on our very first filming of a launch. They counted down, engine, ignition, liftoff, so we knew the missile was underway. We were looking down south, southwest, and the missile popped up through the fog. It was just beautiful and I hollered, "There it is." Our guys on our M45 tracking mount with a 180-inch lens filmed the missile, and the Big Boot telescope swung over and got it and we followed the thing. Sure enough, we could see all three stages of powered flight boosters. They burned out and dropped away. Of course, to our naked eye, all we saw was a smoke trail going off into subspace as it headed toward its target, which was an island in the Pacific. We sent the film back down to the base. A day or two later I was called into Major Mansman's office at the 1st Strategic Aerospace Division headquarters. They had a screen and a 16mm projector set up. There was a couch and Major Mansman told me to sit down. And there were two guys in gray suits, civilian clothes, which was fairly unusual. Major Mansman turned on the film projector. I watched the screen and there was the launch. It was quite exciting. Because of the length of the telescope, we could see the whole Atlas missile as it entered the frame. We watched the first stage burnout. We watched the second stage burnout. We watched the third stage burnout. We could see the dummy warhead flying along. And into the frame came something else. It flew into the frame and it shot a beam of light at the warhead. Now remember, all this stuff is flying at several thousand miles an hour. So this thing, this UFO fires a beam of light at the warhead, hits it and then it moves to the other side and fires another beam of light, then it moves again and fires another beam of light, then it goes down and fires another beam of light, and then it flies out the way it came in. And the warhead tumbles out of space. The warhead was traveling through subspace about 60 miles straight up in the neighborhood of 11 to 14,000 miles an hour when this UFO caught up to it, flew in, flew around it, and flew back out. Now, I saw that. I don't give a goddamn what anybody else says about it. I saw that on film. I was there. When the lights came on, Major Mansman looked at me and said, "Were you guys screwing around up there?" And I said, "No, sir." And he said, "What was that?" And I said, "It looks to me like we got a UFO. Now the thing that we saw, this object that flew in dot, it was circular and shaped like two saucers cupped together with a ping pong ball on top. The beam of light came out of the ping pong ball. That's what I saw on film." After some discussion, Major Mansman told me I was never to speak of this again. As far as I was concerned, this never happened. And he said, "I don't need to emphasize the dire consequences of a security breach, do I?" I said, "No, sir." And he said, "Fine. This never happened." As I started for the door, he said, "Wait a minute." He said, "Years from now, if you are ever forced by someone to talk about this, you are to tell them it was laser strikes, laser tracking strikes." Well, in 1964 we didn't have any laser tracking strikes. We didn't have any laser tracking at all. Lasers were in their infancy in 1964. They were little playthings in laboratories. So I said, "Yes, sir," and walked out, and that was the last I talked about it for 18 years. Much later I learned that, after I left Major Mansman's office, the guys in civilian clothes, they weren't CIA, spooled off the part of the film that had the UFO on it, took a pair of scissors and cut it. They put that on a separate reel and placed it in their briefcase. They handed Major Mansman back the rest of the film and left. For 18 years I was a part of a United States Air Force cover-up. There are still things that I did in the service that I won't talk about because they are top secret and I could get my ass in trouble for talking about them. But after 18 years, it occurred to me that I could talk about this one incident, because nobody ever told me it was classified top secret. Major Mansman had said, "You are to say this never happened." Well, that's not classifying it top secret, is it? That's why I felt free to talk about it. It's not a second-hand story. This happened to me. After an article came out about the incident, the shit hit the fan. I started getting harassed at work. I started getting odd telephone calls that would come during the day. At night, at my house, I would get telephone calls all night long. People would call and start screaming at me, "You are going down, motherfucker." One night somebody blew up my mailbox by putting a big load of skyrockets in it. The mailbox went up in flames. And that night at 1 o'clock in the morning the phone rang. I picked it up and somebody said, "Skyrockets in your box at night, oh what a beautiful sight, motherfucker." Things like that have happened on and off since 1982. Since this History Channel thing came up, I'm starting to get telephone calls again. It's disconcerting. I've been the subject of humiliating letters and phone calls from skeptics like James O'Bear, Gat Nasser and Philip J. Klass, who's a paid informant of the United States government who persisted in belittling me. I've learned to not give a flip. I just don't care anymore. What are they going to do, kill me? Are they going to do discredit me? Are they going to do any more than Philip Klass has already done to make me look foolish? That's about all they can do. The Air Force's position is there was no such incident and there was no film of it. In fact, they've denied everything, from my being in Vandenberg, to me even being in the Air Force. Did I put a tracking site up along the California coast? No. There was no tracking site in California, which is a crock. The tracking site is still right where I put it. And they used it every time the space shuttle landed in California. That's where you first see it from. And they are still photographing missiles from Vandenberg from that tracking site. I believe this nutty fringe around UFOs is part of a concerted effort to keep serious study of it down. Anytime anybody tries to study this subject seriously, we are ridiculed. I'm a full professor at a relatively major university. And I'm certain that my colleagues hoot and holler behind my back when they hear that I have an interest in studying unidentified flying objects. To corroborate my story, Lee Graham tracked down Florence J. Mansman, Jr., the same major who had ordered me to shut up about it. He was a PhD at Stanford and a rancher in Fresno, California. And he wrote back to Lee saying everything Bob said in his story is absolutely true. The thing that's most important to me about this whole operation is very simply this: the biggest event in the history of humankind is the discovery that we are not alone, that there are other living entities. Intelligent entities dot in this universe, and that we aren't here alone. That's a huge, enormous discovery. It's the discovery of the lifetime of humankind, isn't it, to find out that we're not here alone? That's why I think it is important to talk about these things. I think that's exciting. And I think that it's important for us as humans to come to grow up and recognize that we may not be the paragon of animals after all, that there may be something out there that's bigger and more exciting than we are. And that maybe, just maybe, they are telling us something. Because what I saw that day was a UFO shooting down a dummy nuclear warhead. What message would I interpret from that? Don't mess with nuclear warheads, parenthesis. I have interviewed many military officers who have reached the same conclusion after extraterrestrial vehicles have appeared at nuclear facilities. Maybe others have evolved to the point of interstellar travel and know how dangerous these weapons are and understand their use would end our civilization. And they certainly do not want us going into space with such weapons. SG. Testimonial. Lieutenant Colonel Dwin Anson spent 26 years in the USAF. He had an above top secret SCITK, special compartmented Tango Kilo, clearance. He worked as a computer systems analyst for Boeing and was the director of logistics at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. I spent 26 years in the U.S. Air Force as a communication electronics officer, retiring in 1986. I had assignments all over the world, including Vietnam, Europe, you name it, I've probably been there. I held a top secret SCITK clearance. That means special compartmented Tango Kilo information, which is above top secret. It takes a special investigation to get that sort of a clearance. Upon retiring as a colonel in 1986, I came to work for Boeing as a computer systems analyst, and I've been working since 1987 in that capacity with Boeing. I retired in 1986 as director of logistics at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Back in 1962, I was the crypto officer for the entire Ramstein Air Base in Germany. It was in that capacity that I happened to see a classified message go through my comm center which said that a UFO has crashed on the island of Spitsbergen, Norway, and a team of scientists is coming to investigate it. I do not recall where the message came from, but I recall seeing that. Then, in 1967, I was the top secret control officer in charge of the communication center at the 20th Air Division at Malmstrom Air Force Base in Montana. I dispatched all the nuclear launch authentications to the SAC missile crews, so again, I had a very good top secret background. One day, another UFO message came through my communications center. This one said, a UFO was seen near missile silos. It said that the crew going on duty and the crew coming off duty all saw the UFO just hovering in midair. It was a metallic circular object, and from what I understand, the missiles were all shut down. What I mean by shut down is that they went dead. And something turned those missiles off, and so they could not be put in a mode for launching. Years later, while working at Boeing, I heard from a man named Bob Kamenisky. He had retired from Boeing and said that he was the engineer assigned by Boeing to come up and check out the missiles. He said, I gave them a complete bill of health, meaning they had not gone down on their own. Another incident occurred while I was commander of a radar squadron at Caswell Air Force Station in Maine. We were right next door to Loring Air Force Base where they launched the B-52s and the KC tankers and things like that. I had a lot of security friends over at Loring who told me about UFOs hovering near the nuclear weapons storage area, parenthesis, this corroborates the testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Joe Wojdecki. See that testimony regarding a significant event at Loring Air Force Base in my book, Disclosure, Military and Government Witnesses Reveal the Greatest Secrets in Modern History. S.G. Finally, when I was assigned as Director of Logistics at Wright-Patterson. We were the only radar squadron in the US under operational control of the Canadian RAD Division. A lot of technicians that worked for me would tell stories about objects going across their radar screens at fantastic speeds. Nothing we had could go that fast. During that assignment, I had left the wife and kids back in Oklahoma City so my daughter could finish her senior year of high school. I ended up renting a room from an elderly widow, Chris Weed, who had a 5-acre English manor outside of Dayton. Her husband, who had passed away 12 years earlier, was Lieutenant Colonel Spencer Weed, who happened to be one of the lead investigators of UFOs at Wright-Patterson.